Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today for Jeremy Hobson, it's Here and Now. And let's get straight to politics and President-elect Donald Trump's claims without evidence that millions of people voted illegally in the November election. He said that yesterday over Twitter. And today in Wisconsin, elections officials there are meeting to determine a timeline for the recount requested by Green Party candidate Jill Stein. So joining us now with more is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, it's great to talk with you again.
Hi, Meghna. Good to be with you.
So let's start with those recount efforts in Wisconsin, of course, pushed by Green Party candidate Jill Stein. What do we know so far about what the Wisconsin Elections Commission has decided?
They're going to go through with it. They're going to do a recount. They're going to try to verify that the vote counts that were released, which showed Hillary Clinton trailing Donald Trump by about 27,000 votes there in that one state, are accurate, and that there's no evidence in particular of any kind of attempt to influence or hack the actual calculation of those votes, the counting of the votes, the machinery, the computer work. It has been alleged that there are anomalies somewhere in some of the Wisconsin totals that suggest that something might have been amiss. That's what Jill Stein is basing her recount request on, and we're going to see if there's any evidence of that there. She's also talked about doing it in Michigan and Pennsylvania, but we're waiting to see whether or not that will take place.
Now, do we know if there's a specific timeline on when Wisconsin wants to complete the recount?
Oh, I'm sure they're going to want to do it as soon as possible. After all, they want to certify their results before the electors head off to Madison, the state capital, to cast their ballots, presumably for Donald Trump with that 27,000 vote margin. And that's coming up in December. So it's only going to be really a matter of days. We're not talking about weeks and months.
Mm. Now, of course, the president-elect's transition team has heavily criticized the concept of this recount. Where does Hillary Clinton's team stand on them?
Her attorney, her general counsel, Mark Eric Elias, has released a 3-page statement in which they say they are aware of the allegations that have been heard here and there about anomalies, about question marks, about possible foreign interference or hacking, and that they have not seen enough evidence to ask for a recount on their own. However, if Jill Stein wants to have one, the Clinton people say they'll participate insofar as sending representatives and lawyers and so on to take part in this, and they certainly don't want to delegitimize it, but at the same time, they say they didn't have enough evidence to seek it on their own.
Mm. Now, Wisconsin, of course, has 10 electoral college votes, and Donald Trump won the presidency with more than 300 electoral votes. So regardless of what happens in Wisconsin, this is not going to change the outcome of the election in any way. I mean, does it have any political import or significance then?
There's really no evidence that there is going to be any kind of a recount that overturns 27,000 votes. That's just way too large a margin. So what they're really looking for, one has to surmise, is evidence that there was some sort of foul play, that whether or not votes were miscounted at the margin is probably not the ultimate question. The ultimate question here and in those two other states is whether or not somebody was from the outside messing with the computer system in such a way as to really cause major questions about the entire count in those three states. And we should note that if those three states were to flip, that would be enough to overcome Donald Trump's 300 votes in the Electoral College. That is obviously not something anyone really expects to have happen, but as long as people are looking at it, those are the numbers.
Okay. So, Ron, let's turn and talk about Donald Trump's tweet yesterday, that one that grabbed all the headlines, where he claimed that he won the popular vote, quote, if you deduct the millions of people who had voted illegally. Again, that's a claim without any evidence whatsoever. Why would he have tweeted such a thing? What's his possible strategy here?
One can imagine that the last thing that a president-elect wants to have people talking about a couple of weeks after the election is whether or not he legitimately won that election or whether there are question marks hovering over it, particularly because, and I think this really is something that would bother the president-elect, because Hillary Clinton now has about a 2.2 million vote lead in the national popular vote. This clearly is sticking in the president-elect's craw. It's 1.2 6.5% of the vote. It begins to make the polling nationally in the popular vote look pretty good. So he's obviously objecting to that getting so much attention. And by putting out an allegation, even without evidence, that millions of people somewhere voted illegally, he changes the subject and gets us all talking about that.
Well, that's NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving, keeping us on subject as always. Ron, thanks so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, there's news today that an elector has resigned. Remember, the Electoral College was set up by the country's founders to ensure that the presidency never goes to someone not qualified. In other words, the 538 electors can vote for someone other than the candidate picked by their state's voters when they vote on December 19th. Republican Art Cisneros of Texas had been weighing not voting for Donald Trump. And in a blog post over the weekend, he wrote, "Voting for Trump would bring dishonor to God. He will quit rather than do that." But there are efforts underway to get electors to stay and become so-called faithless electors and vote for someone else. There's a Change.org petition with more than 4.5 million signatures calling for them to vote for Hillary Clinton. And there's a pair of Democratic Party electors calling themselves Hamilton electors who want faithless electors to vote for another Republican, not Trump. This will be tough. The Electoral College has only balked twice. And despite the founders' hopes, many state laws now require electors to follow the will of the popular vote or be fined. Michael Baca is co-founder of the Hamilton Electors. He joins us from Denver, Colorado. So, Michael, not since 1824 has this happened, but make your case for faithless electors.
So, ideally, we get 135 Democrats, 135 Republicans to unite around a responsible Republican candidate. And I believe that Donald Trump is a demagogue, and that is someone that should be stopped. And we have the 68th Federalist Paper written by Alexander Hamilton as our guideline, and, you know, of course, the 12th Amendment, which states the rules of the Electoral College.
And remind us, because a lot of people think that electors are bound, that there's a legal binding for them to vote the way the popular vote went in their areas.
So there's 29 states where there are state laws, but the lawyers that we're working with believe that these laws are unconstitutional, and people should feel free to vote their conscience. And so I want to push back on the term faithless electors. I believe that we're being faithful electors or even conscientious electors, because we're making sure that the president doesn't fall to someone without the requisite requirements, such as Donald Trump. And I don't believe he, in his latest Twitter outbreak, we don't believe that he has the demeanor to become the president of the United States.
So we've reported on this. The thinking of the founding fathers was that they weren't for a popular vote. They wanted to set up a system so that electors could be placed across the country so that they could represent areas that may not be represented, for instance, in a huge popular wave of affection for one candidate. Isn't that how the Electoral College worked this time? Because Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 2 million votes.
Well, you know, yes, Hillary Clinton did win. And as a Democrat, it's sad. But we must play within the same rules in the same game. The Republicans won, and, you know, we do respect that. And, you know, we think that 37 out of 306 Republicans will be able to stand up and avoid voting for Donald Trump for the sake of their party and for our country, because they don't want it to risk Zachary Taylor and the Whig Party in 1848. He was an outside president, and due to internal squabbles of the Whig Party, the party ended up collapsing and gave rise to the modern-day Republican Party.
So you and your co-founder were Bernie Sanders delegates. You're not saying vote for Hillary Clinton or vote for Bernie Sanders. You're appealing to Republicans to pick another Republican.
We don't want a Democrat as president. We want to get a Republican, responsible Republican president. Going back to the founding fathers, they were historians of ancient Greece, and they saw the ills in direct democracy. So we live in a democratic republic. People vote on the representatives, and then such as myself go to then vote and make that decision. And I believe it is within our obligation and our duty to unite against Donald Trump and move this country forward.
So you've got you and your co-founder, at least five other Democratic electors have said they would support a Republican rather than Clinton if it's not Trump. You've got one Republican elector who's quit rather than switch to join you and vote for someone other than Trump. So it sounds pretty quixotic. What are you hearing from voters? You drive an Uber now, taking a leave from a master's degree to do this. What are you hearing?
I hear a lot of support for this. I get a good cross-section of Coloradans, and people are very much in support of this because they don't believe Donald Trump. Even I've talked to Republicans that have gotten in the car, and they don't even want Donald Trump to become president. I don't know if he wants himself to become president.
Well, and then you've got another roadblock. Even if you achieve the seemingly unachievable of getting this many electors to change their votes in December, there is then a process that can block that. Is this worth all this effort?
I think so. I'm playing within the rules and trying to prevent a disastrous, I believe, Donald Trump presidency. And I think a responsible Republican will be able to step up and unite this country. And I think that we're making headway. We have 21 days, and every day we've gotten a little bit further. I'm excited. I'm cautiously optimistic.
That's Michael Baca, co-founder of the Hamilton Electors. Michael, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Robin.
Donald Trump pledged that after he's sworn in, he will terminate President Obama's executive orders, including Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. Now, you remember after Congress failed to pass the so-called DREAM Act, Obama issued the DACA order in 2012 to give young adults who'd been brought to the U.S. illegally as children before a certain date work permits and a temporary reprieve from deportation. About 750,000 students and young workers qualified. Then in 2014, Obama moved to expand DACA to include more young people and to protect some parents of children in the country legally. A federal court in Texas blocked that expansion. That ruling went to the Supreme Court, which in June deadlocked 4-4, meaning the Texas ruling blocking Obama's expansion stands. So, what should happen now? Let's start with Mark Krikorian. He's executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, which favors tighter immigration controls. Mark, you agree with the Texas court that expansion of DACA is illegal. But while you think President Obama's executive orders are unconstitutional, you want President-elect Trump to issue one to revoke all of DACA.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an illegal program. The president simply has no authority to grant benefits to, you know, millions of people. And, you know, that's what this is. This isn't just deferral of deportation. This is work permits, Social Security numbers, driver's licenses, access to the earned income tax credit welfare program. There's no path to citizenship here, but it really is a legal status. And Congress, the Democratic Congress in 2010, specifically failed to pass the legislation called the DREAM Act that this executive action was based on. And the president said, well, I'm just going to do it myself. And so the second of the two questions is relevant here, and that is, how will it be ended? Will it be sort of a big bang where Trump on, you know, January 20th says all of this is turned into a pumpkin and you guys are all illegal aliens again? Or will he stop the program, no new grants of DACA, no renewals, but everybody who has it, it will be allowed to kind of run its course, and then it'll end.
Well, let's take the economic repercussions first. Some 645,000 workers would lose their work permits if the program was abruptly ended, as you said, with an executive order. That would cost the U.S. economy $433 billion in lost growth over a decade, according to analysis by the Center for American Progress. Then separately, Arizona has been studied. Between 2007 and 2012, Arizona's population of undocumented workers dropped by 40%. Many were in construction and agriculture. And so between 2008 and 15, a study by Moody's Analytics concluded the departures alone had reduced Arizona's gross domestic product by 2% a year.
Sure it did. Obviously, fewer people means a smaller economy. The question is, are Americans individually better off? That's number one. And number two is, there's stuff a lot more important than aggregate growth. And, you know, really, all the economic arguments for DACA aren't really all that salient because, you know, 750,000 people in an economy in a nation of 320 million people doesn't have really any meaningful effect on the economy. That's just, I just don't buy that.
Well, what about the emotional argument? These are now students, workers, people who, through no choice of their own, were brought here when they were little children because you have to prove that you were here since the age of 16. What about this notion that we're America and children in particular who have had no choice in how they come to this country, we'd be throwing them into a country that they don't know?
couple of things. First of all, it's not like there's ICE people coming at their door at 9 o'clock the next morning.
Well, why not? As your colleague points out, I believe it's John Miano, one of the problems
with that. They have all their names and addresses.
They have their names and addresses. They've registered.
But the fact is they got names and addresses on lots of criminal aliens who are in jail, people that were let go. I mean, I'm not saying that they're not deportable. I'm just saying as a practical matter, you know, it's not like you really need to build a cubbyhole in your garage to hide in. That's the first point. But the second point is, if this is a good argument, and I actually accept the argument, broadly speaking, that illegal immigrants who came here as young children, not 15-year-olds, some of them actually came on their own. I'm talking about kids who actually spent most of their childhoods in the United States
before age
7 or 10, something like that. Giving those kids amnesty is a good idea. I'm actually for that as part of a package in Congress that includes enforcement trade-offs, things like that. But Congress has not passed that. And there's all kinds of things that I think are good policy that I don't just get to do if I'm president.
But you say it should be passed by Congress, but as you well know, this Congress would not.
Maybe not. Number one, if that were true, so what? I mean, as the elected representatives of the people, that's the way it is. But I would also submit that a deal specifically targeted toward the Dreamers, I would not assume that something like that couldn't pass. In fact, part of the reason that this issue with the Dreamers and now DACA has dragged on for so long is that the advocates have refused to focus just on fixing that problem. They always have used it as a kind of advertising gimmick for amnestying all the other illegal immigrants. And if they at some point decide the Dreamers want to cut a separate deal to fix their problem, I actually think that's not impossible.
Mark, thank you. That's Mark Krikorian, Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies. So let's bring in Zulema Dominguez, a 23-year-old student at Hunter College in New York and a member of the Youth Power Project for the advocacy group Make the Road New York. She was brought to the U.S. from Puebla, Mexico, when she was 7. She's now a DACA recipient who signed up for a renewal in August, which current DACA recipients are encouraged to do. But Zulema, how are you feeling about your future right now?
Well, as for now, after the elections, I've been feeling overwhelmed, and I've been having a lot of anxiety. I have no idea what will be my future in the next few days, and that's the anxiety I'm having as for now.
And what does, you tell us, what does DACA provide for you?
Well, DACA, first of all, it provided me a better job where with my salary, I could be able to help my family. And second, to continue with my education, which was the main idea. Because I was able to, with DACA, I was able to apply for a Social Security card. And with the Social Security number, you can apply for a scholarship and continue with your education.
Yeah, well, you know what the arguments are. There are some people who feel there are just too many immigrants in the country and they don't want to see a path to citizenship for any undocumented immigrant. But we also hear the constitutional argument that the fact that it was an executive order is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court split on that question. What about taking your chances with Congress, having this kicked back to Congress to vote on it?
Well, I think it's a politics game, you know. Is it the Congress precedent? It's back and forth. And as for now, it's we're going to fight them back. We have fear, but we deserve our respect and dignity.
Well, do you also feel, you know, as if your whole livelihood, your future has been in other people's hands, brought here to the U.S. by family? The Congress under the Obama administration, it was 5 Democrats voting against this bill in the Senate. That is the reason it didn't pass. Do you feel a little bit let down by other people, by the Obama administration, by maybe even your parents who brought you, not understanding maybe the consequences?
I mean, I can't blame my parents for wanting their child to have a better future. However, I mean, government always tries to play with our lives, where Republicans say we're going to deport 11 million, or the Democratic Party deports 2 to 3 million undocumented during the Obama administration. You know, and I think that's what Donald Trump wants to repeat. And what this politician doesn't see is that they're tearing apart families that are contributing to this country by calling them criminals.
What might happen to you? I mean, you say you're here to stay, and others are saying that in all likelihood, the Dreamers, people under DACA, may not be deported. I mean, there's people with criminal histories ahead of you in line. But what would it mean for you if DACA went away, whether you could stay here or not?
I mean, you know, it would be much harder than what it is now. But I have always, you know, I've been living without DACA like for almost 11, 12 years of my life. It doesn't mean that DACA would stop everything. Like I said, we will be continue fighting for a reform for everybody.
So this notion that if you lose DACA, you'll leave, you're saying no.
No, I mean, I have nowhere to leave. You know, I found this country as my country. I grew up in here. I graduated from elementary school all the way to high school, and I finished my associates in a community college. I'm in a four-year college. So I found this is my country. I've been contributing. I just need one chance from all these politicians and for them to stop playing with my life and my future.
Do you worry, Zulema, that one of the things DACA required is that you register? And so all of your information, your contact information where you live, is with immigration services.
Of course. I mean, you know, that's the biggest fear I have right now as for my family. What about if immigration goes and by any chance my siblings or my parents open the door, then they will be on risk of deportation.
That's Zulema Dominguez, a 23-year-old student at Hunter College and a DACA recipient, awaiting to see what happens to that program. Zulema, thanks for speaking with us.
No, thank you for having me here.
In Syria today, government forces recaptured some rebel-held areas of Aleppo. It's the first time those neighborhoods have been in government hands in 4 years. The civil war between the rebels and the forces of President Assad are part of a complicated conflict in Syria. There are Shiite militias from Iraq, Iran, and Lebanon supported by Russian airstrikes fighting with the Assad regime. The U.S., which has opposed President Assad, is helping the rebels but also fighting ISIS there. And on Thanksgiving Day, the first American casualty in Syria was recorded. Senior Chief Petty Officer Scott Dayton was killed near Raqqa. Thomas Gibbons Neff is a reporter for The Washington Post. He's also a former Marine who served two tours in Afghanistan. He's with us from the Post studio in Washington. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, let's begin with the death of U.S. sailor Scott Dayton. Who was he and what exactly happened?
Right. So, I mean, details are still pretty scarce. We know he was killed by wounds suffered from an improvised explosive device. So that's an IED or roadside bomb. Last month in Mosul, Chief Petty Officer was also killed, Jason Finnan. And he was assigned to a similar unit based out of California. And he was operating with a team of Navy SEALs in Mosul when he was killed. So I think we can say, you know, likely that Dayton was working with Special Operations Forces north of Raqqa.
Mm. So tell us, I mean, at this point in time, how many U.S. troops are operating in Syria and how much do we know about exactly what they're doing?
So it's kind of an amorphous number. We know that it's around 500. There was 200 initially sent at the tail end of 2015 and another 200 were authorized in April to go in. That being said, people probably fly in and out of Turkey and Iraq to kind of support and assist certain missions. But basically, their core mission is supporting what's called the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is kind of a hodgepodge of Arab and Kurdish militias. And they're basically there in an advisory role. They're supporting and assisting them, helping them take territory from the Islamic State by way of, you know, getting close air support in and also providing weaponry that maybe they don't have, including some advanced anti-tank guided missiles like the Javelin.
Okay. So speaking of like bringing in the air support, as we mentioned earlier in the introduction, Russia says it's also fighting ISIS. I mean, are the American and Russian militaries cooperating in any way in Syria?
The U.S. takes a pretty hard line, is that they don't coordinate with Russia at all unless they're de-conflicting. How true is that is hard to tell. Maybe there are certain situations where they share maybe a little more than just, hey, we're flying up here. But for the most part, we kind of stay away from each other up there.
Mm. Now, could you tell me a little bit more? I mean, I'm thinking about what happened to Chief Petty Officer Scott Dayton. I mean, is the U.S. helping rebels specifically, you know, in close contact with them who are fighting the Assad regime?
Now, our special forces in Syria are not with troops that are fighting the Assad regime or Assad's forces. They're fighting groups that are fighting specifically the Islamic State. That being said, there are training programs, namely the one for the Central Intelligence Agency, that trains Syrian rebels to fight the Islamic State. However, they also fight the Islamic State and the Syrian government forces.
And finally, Thomas, earlier this month, three U.S. soldiers were killed in Jordan. And I think it's probably quite a surprise to many Americans to know that there are U.S. troops in that country and also that they're even in harm's way. I mean, so what were they doing there and what more do we know about how they were killed?
Jordan's been a huge asset and ally for the U.S. forces in the region, you know, when it comes to fighting the Islamic State, supporting operations in Syria. And what we know is that these soldiers, they were all from 5th Special Forces Group based out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and they were hashed over to the Central Intelligence Agency, who runs that training program that trains Syrian so-called moderate fighters to go back into Syria and fight ISIS and Syrian forces. So basically, they were pulling up to this gate. They were in a bunch of vehicles. They had just come back from a range training Syrian fighters, and the Jordanian guard opened fire, killed two guys in one of the vehicles. And another two special forces soldiers jumped out. One was gunned down as they ran for cover, and the final one, the fourth one, returned fire with his service pistol and wounded the shooter, who is currently in a coma.
So the shooter was Jordanian, and was this a Jordanian base that they were returning to or an American one?
A Jordanian base that had Americans present.
Thomas Gibbons Neff is a reporter for The Washington Post. Thomas, thank you so very much.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Let's turn now to South Carolina and the trial of Dylann Roof. Surprising events there today. The 22-year-old self-proclaimed white supremacist has requested to serve as his own lawyer. And that request was granted by a federal judge. Roof is accused of gunning down nine black worshipers in June 2015 at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. Federal prosecutors are seeking the death penalty in this case. For more, we're joined now by Glenn Smith, special projects editor for the Post and Courier in Charleston. Glenn, welcome back to the show. And first of all, what did Dylann Roof say when he made this request to represent himself?
Well, jury selection was scheduled to get underway today after a three-week delay, much of which was taken to determine whether he was competent to stand trial. Then he made a surprise move this morning, got up before the judge, and indicated that he wanted to represent himself. The judge strongly cautioned him against that, but in the end he said he does have the capacity for self-representation, so he granted that request.
I see that the judge had said that it was a strategically unwise move. And again, just to reiterate, this is a death penalty case now. Now you mentioned that the judge had said that it was determined that he had the capacity to do so because there had been questions previously about Roof's mental state?
Yeah, back on November 8th, jury selection was scheduled to begin. They had summoned about 512 people who had made it through the first cut. They had originally called 3,000 people from throughout the region to serve as potential jurors and go through this process. As they were about to begin, the judge said that there had been a last-minute motion regarding his competency and status, and they decided to adjourn the proceedings until a competency hearing could be conducted. All that was done behind closed doors over the last few weeks, despite protests from both the victims' families and the media in the area.
Mm. Now, did Dylann Roof say anything else about why he wanted to represent himself, or did he say anything of anything more of significance in court today?
Now, from what I've been told, he arrived in a striped gray and white jail uniform, and he basically just answered the judge's questions with "yes, sir." I was told he spoke in a quiet, raspy voice, didn't have much to say. Afterwards, he smiled slightly as he returned to the defense table. He took his seat in the lead attorney's spot, and his previous lead attorney, noted capital defense attorney David Brock, he moved over and let him take the driver's seat.
Wow. And then did jury selection proceed as it was supposed to?
Yeah, it's underway as we're speaking right now.
So Roof himself is doing the vetting of the jurors for his defense?
Correct. In consultation with Mr. Brock and some others on the defense team, they have been kept on as advisors but he certainly doesn't have to take their advice. From what I've been seeing so far from the courtroom, the attorneys for the prosecution have spoken up about a couple potential jurors. The judge has been questioning jurors on their thoughts on the death penalty. So far, Mr. Roof has had little or nothing to say. He's pretty much agreed to whoever has come before him, I think.
Now, what has been the reaction from victims' families, if we know, about Dylan Roof's decision to represent himself?
We've been unable to talk to them as yet because the proceeding is underway. I know our reporter who's in the courtroom said that the victims' families, the survivors, people from the Emmanuel AME Church are taking up pretty much the first three rows of the courtroom, and they didn't show any noticeable reaction when it was announced that he was going to represent himself.
Do we have any sense as to how long jury selection is going to take and when the next phase of the trial may begin?
Well, I think today that this is somewhat of a game changer. When we had talked to some of the attorneys involved a few weeks back, they were estimating it could go 3-4 weeks as they vetted people on their feelings on the death penalty. Certainly there's, you know, a lot at stake here. But with Mr. Roof in the driver's seat, it's anybody's guess. He could decide to challenge a whole bunch of people. He could just let them all go. It really remains to be seen.
Well, Glenn Smith is special projects editor for The Post and Courier in Charleston, talking to us about Dylan Roof's surprise move to represent himself in his federal hate crimes trial. Glenn, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
And here are a couple of stories we're following today. The first regularly scheduled commercial flight from the U.S. to Havana in more than 50 years landed this morning. The AP reports passengers aboard the American Airlines flight cheered as the plane touched the ground at Jose Marti International Airport. American Airlines had a small celebration before the flight departed and handed out straw hats that read Cuba to passengers, many of whom were on an emotional journey, arriving in a Cuba officially mourning the death of Fidel Castro on Friday night. Also today, and staying with flight, Lufthansa, the German airline, is canceling more than 1,700 flights scheduled for tomorrow and Wednesday. The pilots' union is continuing a series of strikes that started last week. The dispute between the union and the airline has been going on for more than 2 years. Lufthansa says it's seeking an injunction from a German court to halt the walkout tomorrow. The airline was not able to convince the courts to end last week's strikes. Well, hospitals used to be required to perform autopsies on at least 20% of patients who died on premise. Many autopsied more than that. But in 1970, the requirement was lifted, and the number of autopsies has been falling ever since. Not counting patients who died of external causes like car accidents, hospitals autopsied an average of just 3.9% of patients in 2014. Why? Well, it can be hard to ask families to sign off on the procedure. Insurance often doesn't cover it. And technology has made doctors increasingly more trusting of their own diagnoses. Still, many doctors are pushing for more autopsies. Irina Joroff attended one to find out why.
How much does he weigh?
170.
Perfect. Wish I weighed 170.
Dr. Robert Owenby, a pathologist who heads up the Hahnemann Hospital Autopsy Unit in Philadelphia, suits up in a blue plastic gown and latex gloves before approaching the patient on the metal table.
He's a 64-year-old gentleman, and his only significant history is hypertension and Parkinson's for 30 years.
The man died 3 days ago. Owenby, a team of residents, and a technician whose job it is to do the actual cutting are investigating what killed the man and what was going on in his body at the time of death. The procedure is incredibly hands-on.
You use 4 of your 5 senses. You can guess which one you don't use.
The residents do a physical exam, feeling for abnormalities. When they're ready to cut, they cover the dead man's face with a blue towel. Concealing his gaze feels appropriate somehow. Fred Radhoff, the technician, makes a Y incision, 2 diagonal cuts on the chest and 1 down the belly.
I'm going to take this down to the pubis, go around the umbilicus.
He's wearing a mask, so he's a little muffled. Owenby tracks his progress as Radhoff pulls back the skin with its layer of yellow fat tissue to reveal the bowels.
You may detect an odor.
Radhoff prepares to remove the rib cage. He tells a student it's okay to draw a line along which to saw.
Many people will do this to give themselves a guide. I've been doing it so long, I really don't need it.
Radhoff has been doing this for nearly 20 years. He uses what's called a striker saw. It cuts bone, but not flesh. And a favorite trick in the autopsy room is to put the spinning blade to your palm and freak out first-timers like me. Radhoff opens the chest cavity to reveal the heart and lungs.
Nice lungs.
Yeah, really. Nice and pink.
Non-smoker? Wow.
Doctors suspected a stroke killed him, but couldn't confirm. The patient's family requested an autopsy to clarify what happened and see if there were any genetic problems they should be aware of. Doctors told me for families, the final autopsy report brings closure. For doctors, it's quality control and learning something new.
We often find things that are unexpected at autopsy.
Studies show that autopsies turn up contradicting causes of death. For example, a doctor blames pneumonia, but an autopsy reveals that it was actually a tumor.
That's despite the fact that we have all this technology, this wonderful imaging that's very specific.
Doctors can also see how a treatment, like chemo, for example, affected a patient and approached similar patients accordingly. Radhoff suctions out fluid and scoops out organs to give to the residents working across the room. He takes them out in blocks so the pathologist can check for problems in the connections between organs. Adeola Tomiolugbodi, a third-year resident in pathology, weighs, measures, feels for abnormalities, and slips the organs into a solution to prepare them for lab work.
We're contributing to the body of science from what we find.
It's very clinical, almost makes you forget you're dealing with a person. Still, ONB gets that none of that is enough to convince some people to send loved ones to autopsy. I ask him if he wants one when he goes.
I've gone back and forth about that, to be honest. To some extent, for myself anyway, religion and the mystery about what happens after death comes into play. Am I going to need my organs when when that happens? Realistically, of course, no. But yeah, I think I would probably want an autopsy performed.
ONB says they do everything possible to accommodate families with similar concerns, but where bodies are involved, even science may not answer every question. As for the patient, the family may wait a month or two to see if the complete autopsy report brings clarity. For Here and Now, I'm Irina Zhorov in Philadelphia.
And Irina's report comes to us from WHYY's health and science program, The Pulse. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.